This WBEZ podcast is supported by Invisible Wounds Foundation, committed to healing military members living with brain injuries suffered in service. Thousands of service members are living with traumatic and devastating brain injuries that we can't see. Join the mission by texting DUTY to 53555 to give, or learn more at invisiblewounds.org.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
Hey, Chicago. I'm your host, Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Stick around for a breakdown of the day's biggest local stories later in the podcast. But first, there's a lot of heated discussion in Chicago City Council about Mayor Brandon Johnson's latest budget proposal. The city has to pass a new budget by the end of the year, and the clock is ticking. The mayor's been in town halls across the city trying to gain support for his initiatives to balance the city's finances. But the one getting the most pushback from some alders and interest groups is his plan to bring back a corporate head tax. That's a tax that bigger corporations would pay for each person they employ. Now, former City Inspector General Joe Ferguson is weighing in on Mayor Johnson's latest budget proposal, and he's urging the city government to re-examine its spending before our financial picture gets much worse. We'll dig into what he calls three fundamental problems with the mayor's 2026 proposed budget and how Chicago can work toward fiscal responsibility. Later this week, we'll hear from the mayor himself about the critique his budget is getting during Ask the Mayor. Now, at the table for this conversation, Joe Ferguson, president of the Civic Federation and former inspector general for the city of Chicago. Now, Joe, you start your piece in Crane Chicago Business about this budget proposal by saying, quote, Chicago has reached a fiscal tipping point. What did you mean by that?
So we've been talking about the fact that Chicago's fiscal situation has been close to the edge for a very long time. We're talking about decades of fiscal mismanagement, poor budgetary practices. We've had points where we were at the ledge and then we borrowed a whole lot more to prevent that. This time is different. It's different because the magnitude of the legacy costs are higher than ever. The federal government is not coming in to help, and the state government does not have the capacity to help because it has its own fiscal issues to deal with, which means we have met the enemy and it is us. We have to be our own solution. And in that context, there are things that might in other times be off on the table that are off the table. This morning's news about property tax bills, which everyone experienced over the weekend. But the aggregate numbers are really startling. Tell us property taxes is not something that's available to us this year.
So let's dig right into what you lay out as three problems in the mayor's budget. Number one, higher taxes with no real savings. What exactly is wrong here?
So we should be starting out with efficiencies, savings, and, you know, where reasonable, probably cuts. We have never done that. There is a huge amount of waste in the city's budget and operations that can be trimmed down and much of it monetized, freeing up money that's in the budget actually to attend to our deficit situation. We haven't done that work as a city. This go round, the mayor actually did a great thing. He hired a consulting firm that's really good with this sort of stuff. Their specialization, the folks that were hired at Ernst Young, EY, have a specialization with cities and governments in fiscal distress. And they identified a whole menu of potential savings and efficiencies, and almost none of them were relied upon in the context of this budget. So there's a lot of opportunity there.
Did that surprise you?
Yeah. let's put it this way. It's disappointing. I'm a parent. You're a parent. We go to the disappointed place. Mm-hmm. It is disappointing. We paid over $3 million to the consulting firm, a reasonable cost. They do it as a loss leader. And put on the table really marshaled what are a couple of decades worth of ideas and serve them up so that the city council could engage and so the administration could actually dig in. And the range is upwards of $1.4 billion in savings. They can't all be implemented right away. But this budget, as proposed, included only $12 million in structural savings when the deficit is over a billion.
Yeah. On Wednesday at a town hall, Mayor Johnson said, quote, "City Council has two options. They can tax the rich or they can decimate services and tax working class people." Is this an either or to you?
No, it's not an either or. It's a clean your room situation. We are spending more energy and effort avoiding dealing with our problems than would take to deal with our problems. And no, they're not all solvable at once. But again, back to the savings efficiencies spoken of for decades within the city budget itself, they're not on the table as part of this budget. That is the middle way, and that comes first before we go to the taxpayers and ask them for more.
So one of the concessions that Johnson is offering is a revision of that corporate head tax, right? And now you're smiling, so I know there's a thought there. But basically he's saying now instead of just this applying to companies with 100 employees or more, it'll be 200 people or more at these companies. Your thoughts?
One, it manifests weakness and maybe that the votes aren't there. Two, it manifests a broadening from a political ideological spectrum of people who appreciate that continuing to pile on corporations is actually hurting us and our ability to grow the base that's actually the revenue base, which is actually critically necessary to get out of the mess that we're in.
And for the person who doesn't quite get it, take us back to the first time around when this was a thing, right? We had a corporate head tax.
We did.
In Chicago. It was repealed in 2014 by Mayor Rahm Emanuel. How did it work exactly?
So it is, and you can set it at different levels, but it is a set amount of money that a corporation must pay to the city for each employee that it has working in the city of Chicago. It's a jobs tax. It's a jobs tariff. We want business to hire people in Chicago. And there is a whole multiplier effect in terms of commercial activity, retail activity, resident, all sorts of things that come from that. And at the margin, what it does is it disincentivizes business from hiring people in Chicago mm-hmm. to work in Chicago. And what is different this time from the past is the capacity for escape strategies, hybrid work. You have more work being done remotely. Corporations can move. A lot of the work that actually is fundamental to our economy doesn't require physical placement here to have access to the markets here. And so what it does is it encourages corporations to continue to leave.
Yeah. What other taxes or fees in the budget proposal do you take issue with or do you agree with?
So again, start with savings and efficiencies so that we know what we actually need. Second, one of the things here that is done is a revisitation of the bad practices of the past in that we're actually in this proposal borrowing money for operating costs.
That was your second problem in the piece.
We have to attend to that. Yes, we have to find money for that. The question of what forms of revenue require a broader vision-oriented thinking. What is going to encourage business activity? What is going to encourage people to come, incentivize people to come and live in Chicago? Because we need a growing population as well. And it's a mix of a number of things, but I will say this for all of the narrative about the need to tax the ultra rich, mm-hmm. this budget is chock-a-block with all sorts of things that are paid for by ordinary Chicagoans.
Yeah, so this idea of borrowing for operations. You write that what Johnson's doing is equivalent to a payday loan. Have other mayors used this tactic?
Other mayors have used this tactic. That's why we're in the mess that we're in right now. We have lots of legacy debt. Between our legacy long-term debt and our pension obligations, which everyone knows are immense because we didn't pay in the ways that we should have all along, 40% of Chicago's net operating expenditures go to debt and pension obligations. The biggest impact that that has is on the crowding out effect, the so-called crowding out effect. Government actually can't do what we all think we're paying for government to do, or at least do less of it. And who tends to be most disadvantaged in that regard? The historically disinvested communities. And so the past practices that have gotten us into this mess, the mayor has critiqued them. He has critiqued them in present terms, in past terms.
And you're saying now he's doing them.
And now he's doing them.
Let's get into your third problem here with the budget proposal, and that's cutting advanced pension payments, right? So break this down in layman's terms so my mom, who just turned 72 yesterday, can understand.
Basically, what is supposed to happen is we take a percentage of an employee's check and direct it to a pension fund. The employer matches. For many years, over decades, in a number of units of government, we have had holidays that has resulted in a suspension of payments into our various pensions. In Chicago, it's a fairly extraordinary place that we're in. The police and fire pensions are at the low 20s relative to what they need to pay future obligations. That means we need to catch up. State law has set a ramp for how we catch up. And one of the ways that we have actually improved our credit rating in recent years is to do what has been referred to as a supplemental payment that actually is bringing us closer to the point of catching up. And then in the spring, labor-supported legislators at the end of the spring session introduced legislation that added to that burden and brings police and fire projected to be at 18% funding, which national standards say almost certainly to go bankrupt. What it means is that we are paying in real time. Employees are paying in real time money, not for their retirement, but to meet the benefits of current retirees, which means there's nothing for the future. That's the hole that we're in.
You do write in this section of your piece, here's the good news. The mayor was forward-thinking enough to commission the consulting group Ernst & Young. You ultimately say that he's not taking enough tips and tactics that were suggested in their report that they put together.
That's right. Again, the range of relatively near-term savings and efficiencies were from about $500 million to $1.4 billion. Remember, our budget deficit is just under $1.2
billion.
There are only $12 million dollars in structural savings built into the mayor's proposal. So it's not just the mayor. It's an opportunity for the city council to actually step into this space. The city council endeavored to do so. They've largely been obstructed or deflected from actually digging into what's behind the face of this report to identify a much more robust number of savings and efficiencies that bring down the need for revenue, new revenue options.
I want to go back to that corporate head tax you mentioned earlier. You said essentially that it was a job killer, right? The Nonpartisan Institute for the Public Good said when Rahm Emanuel repealed the previous head tax, Chicago didn't see a huge surge in job growth in the aftermath. And other reporting and analyses also support that conclusion. So, I mean, it is a matter of debate, but it doesn't look like the tax has a huge impact, I would say, on job growth or decline one way or another.
It does. It does at the margin. Businesses make decisions at the margin. The most robust period of job growth in Chicago over the last 25 to 30 years was from 2014 to 2020, immediately after the job tax. The head tax was repealed. Correlation is not necessarily causation, but we have a lot of work to do to determine just actually what the strength of that reaction is. And again, as I noted earlier, corporations have a whole lot more available to them in strategies to actually avoid this. This tax is five times what it was back at the time that Emanuel pulled it back. And there is only one other city in the United States that has a job tax like this. It's Denver.
How'd it work out there?
It's at the margin, you know, they're holding on. The only other city to have tried this was Seattle, where Washington Post this morning writing about socialist Seattle. It went to the voters almost immediately after it was implemented and repealed 1 month later. But any other city that has tried this has tried it at a fractional level of what we're proposing to do it at. So this is just completely experimental.
So as we're starting to wrap here, Joe, anything you like with this budget that we didn't get to touch on?
Look, the mayor's values are the values that we should all carry. It's the execution on those values, which have been posed as either ors, that is not going to get us where we need to get to. Yes, there needs to be more investment in community. It has a lot of that investment in community. But it needs to be done in a way that is actually sustainable and structurally responsible. We are sitting on the verge of a credit downgrade. Standard & Poor's, immediately after the mayor issued his budget, issued a negative outlook for the city that basically outlined all the things that need to come out to avoid a downgrade. A downgrade means it's more expensive for us to borrow. That borrowing goes for economic development. Economic development in communities, we need that economic development to grow our way out of the place that we're in.
That was Joe Ferguson, president of the Civic Federation and former inspector general for the city of Chicago, with a critique of Mayor Johnson's budget proposal. Now, Friday, we're going to hear from Mayor Johnson himself and allow him to respond to many of these points. Tune in for Ask the Mayor on In the Loop live on Friday morning at 9 on 91.5 WBEZ. We'll talk more about the budget, and you will have a chance to ask Mayor Johnson your questions. Now to the big local headlines. At the table to make it all make sense, WBEZ's Claire Lane and Michael Puente and Jody Cohen from ProPublica. We started with Mike giving us an update on the National Guard troops leaving Chicagoland. Here's Mike.
Well, they really have nothing to do. They were deployed.
I was wondering what they've been doing.
That might be it. You know, they're down there in Elwood near Joliet. They were just, well, we were down there, what, maybe feels like a month or two ago, and they were never deployed on the streets of Chicago. A judge halted that. President Trump activated them. He activated them, but he didn't get the authority to actually bring him to Chicago because there's really no need for it. And a judge agreed with the city and the attorney general that there is no need for the National Guard troops to be here in Chicago. So they've been in Elwood and... You know, that's been their mission to be in
To be honest, I thought they were already gone. I thought when the judge said what she said and we got that temporary restraining order, that meant bye, but I guess not. These troops that we're talking about, though, who are leaving, they're from Texas. A few hundred of National Guard troops from Illinois are still activated, as I understand. Anybody know what their role would be now?
Well, again, it's similar to Texas. There's no role.
Just wait and see.
Just wait and see. They've been activated, which the president has the authority to do. He just doesn't have the ability to get them on the streets the way he wants to.
Mm-hmm. Claire, two clergy members protesting outside the Broadview ICE facility on Friday. They're calling on Governor Pritzker to answer for the police's use of force there. What happened?
That's correct. So this is Reverend Michael Wolf and Pastor Luke Harris Ferry said that they were targeted, essentially, while they were praying outside of the U.S. Customs and Immigration Enforcement Facility in Broadview. 21 people were arrested during Friday's protest. The Cook County Sheriff's Office's four officers were also injured during that protest. But the Sun-Times report that the sheriff's office did not answer if any changes have been made, to those people that were taken and arrested on Friday. Wolf said officers wrestled him to the ground, we should note, and pressed his knees to his body. Pastor Harris Ferry said he and others were plucked physically from this line of people protesting in Broadview. And he essentially, as you said, accused the state and the county police of actively aiding in ISIS, what he called racist terror, and saying that, you know, what many people have also been saying, that this violates the state's trust act.
Right. Yeah. I should mention, as we're talking about Broadview, we got some sad news on Friday. Sister Joanne Persch, who is known for her tireless advocacy on behalf of migrants and refugees, she's with Sisters of Mercy. She died on Friday. She was on the show
a
little over a month ago. I spoke with her about just how she had been feeling about what was taking place almost weekly outside of the Broadview facility. And unexpectedly, they say she passed away at the age of 91. Now, you'll recall we talked in our conversation with Sister Joanne about the fact that her decades-long partner in ministry to migrants and refugees, Sister Pat Murphy, died this year as well. She died in July, and now Sister Joanne. So thinking of them both, thoughts and prayers to both of their families.
And supporting their causes till the end, truly.
Now, Jody, you and four colleagues, now you've got an investigation that's out right now. It's on what happened after that raid that we saw on a South Shore apartment building in September. So first, take us back, because September, with these daily updates we've been getting on ICE, September feels like a world away. So what took place that night in September?
It does feel like a world away, but that was really a very dramatic moment in this whole immigration blitz here in Chicago, because that was the night where just after midnight, there, you might remember, there was the big apartment building on the South Shore, and there were Black Hawk helicopters, agents rappelling down to the building, and in the middle of the night, people, U.S. citizens and immigrants taken from the building, zip-tied, and there was a camera crew invited to attend and film it. And
not just any camera crew, Jody. Let's not downplay that Hollywood action movie that came from this raid.
And the Department of Homeland Security posted their own videos of the raid and said that there was this raid was so important because this building was filled with terrorists and Tren de Aragua terrorists from Venezuela, and they were making Chicago safer by detaining people from that building. And that's what happened on September 30th.
And the Trump administration says two confirmed members of the Tren de Aragua gang were captured in that raid, including someone on a terrorist watch list. Now, ProPublica investigated, so tell us what you found.
Right. So we spend time investigating the government's claims, and they made one of the claims was that there were these two gang members. They, of course, never said who they were. We were able to identify 21 of the 37 detained, and my colleague Melissa Sanchez spoke with 12 of them. And we were also able to figure out who one of the people that the administration said was one of the gang members. Melissa also spoke with him. And while they made these claims, there was no evidence of terrorist gang members in that building. We were able to, because we had the names, background them, look at their records. No one was ever on a gang list. They almost none of them had any kind of criminal activity in their backgrounds. And
not the story we first heard.
Right. Exactly.
What else can you share about the Venezuelan immigrants that you interviewed? Because you got into some really personal stories.
Right. So there were, and a lot of it was not shown on TV that night, or, you know, from the camera crews, that there were women and children who were taken. They were 17 of the men were put on a bus and bused to a jail in Indiana. One of them, you know, had to use the bathroom and urinated on himself in the on the bus. They have been held in detention. We've been able to watch some of their immigration court hearings, where again the government has not provided any criminal history for any of the men. Many of them have asked for voluntary departure, and the judge has granted that. That is not granted to people who have safety risks, who are, you know, criminals. We've learned a lot about them.
Wow, so much more. Mike, it brings me back to, I mean, when we first talked about this raid on the Daily News update, and so much more that we're learning from this investigation. What comes to mind for you?
Well, what comes to mind is that it's not surprising. It's great reporting by ProPublica, great reporting on their part, but it just goes back to this history of DHS in Chicago of bending the truth or downright lying about what they've been doing in the city. Greg Bovino has already shown to have lied under oath in front of Judge Sarah Ellis, who called him out, who said he had been hit by a rock in Little Village. That wasn't true. Mm. Not sure why he wasn't held in contempt of court. But this is a pattern now by DHS of not giving the full facts of what's happening, not just here, which is one of the most high-profile raids in the city, but in other situations, with a situation that happened in Gary, Indiana, with a family where they pulled them out, including locking up American citizens.
Right.
This is happening everywhere. We're seeing now that they're in North Carolina doing this harassment, and it's, again, it feels like it's all for shock and awe.
Just moving from one Democrat-led city to another.
The Friday, the government gave a list to the judge of the hundreds of people on the list who were part of different enforcement activities in Chicago where there were no warrants, and who, you know, there's 600 and some names on the list, and only 2% or 16 of them had any, you know, criminal activity considered high risk. And that, like you just said, like Michael just said, it's South Shore raid. Some of those people are on that list, actually, the list that's circulating.
Yeah.
The ones who are still in detention, you know, some are already back in Venezuela.
The question I have is, how did the South Shore apartment complex get on the radar of ICE in the first place? Was it that they know that this is a downtrodden area? They're probably going to close the building anyway. They've been, have all kind of like foreclosure issues with the city. So how did they get on that radar?
Yeah. So we'll get more on Jody's story about immigration enforcement in just a moment. But first, Claire, I want to talk about air travel because I feel like there's been enough time. Are we back to normal here?
In Chicago, we are pretty much back to normal. So the FAA essentially just lifted all restrictions at 40 major U.S. airports related to the government shutdown and short staffing. This went into effect at 5 o'clock this morning, Central Time, we should note, at both O'Hare and Midway, as well as several other airports across the country. So the flight cuts, as we know, they sort of started at 4%. People were like, oh, okay, maybe we'll deal. And then later they grew to 6%, and that's when we really started seeing some of these cancellations. At several points, O'Hare was leading the nation for most cancellations across the country. But so far, as of this morning, happy to report one cancellation at O'Hare and none at Midway. So we should be back in business
getting back to normal. Love that. Mike, SNAP benefits finally flowing in full now to Illinois recipients?
They should be getting their full SNAP benefits by Wednesday.
Okay.
That's according to the state. You know, they started flowing last week once the government shutdown ended. And the city of Chicago, the mayor, Brandon Johnson, also issued an executive order to kind of supplement those SNAP benefits for people who had, you know, who still aren't getting the full amount. So that's supposed to help restaurants and businesses who are impacted by this.
Mm-hmm.
But it should happen by midweek.
Yeah. Well, food pantries, though, they're still seeing unprecedented demand. Over the weekend, Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson also took steps. He was trying to address food insecurity. What did he do?
He signed an executive order. He's going to get more city resources to those food pantries and to individuals and to businesses who have been impacted with the loss of these SNAP benefits over the past month.
We should add that food pantries in Chicago are sort of questioning whether people are going to be scarred by this, losing access to these SNAP benefits, and that it's probably going to take time to rebuild that trust with the federal program.
That was stressful those days, right? When we had no idea what was going to happen.
The government shutdown ended, but you know, I guess there's an agreement to keep this going all the way through next September. So what's going to happen in a year from now when, you know, all this gets played out again?
Certainly larger implications, especially here in Chicago.
So a story that we've been watching closely, the Reverend Jesse Jackson was hospitalized last week, but his family has given an update on his condition.
Yes, the update as of this morning is that he has been stabilized, he's in stable condition, and he's no longer on a breathing machine.
Okay.
So that was the big news from last week, that he needed breathing assistance. We all know he's had this neurological condition for some time, but he's breathing on his own. In a statement, Jackson's family says he remains under the care of physicians and just very thankful to the medical team at Northwestern. That's the latest.
What else are you watching?
Well, this is kind of interesting. Lisa Curry and Philip had some numbers this morning for WBEZ that the number of students who have signed up at Illinois community colleges That has surpassed pre-pandemic levels. So
people
are seeking affordable and accessible higher education in our state. But they also say this data that federal immigration enforcement has led to a drop in the number of students that are taking sort of adult ed, like ESL classes, English as a second language. So more data to come, but pretty interesting from WBEZ's Lisa Corey and Phillip.
Now, Jody, let's turn back to your reporting on that big South Shore raid. I want to play, first of all, a clip here. This is of WhatsApp messages that were exchanged between two residents. It's in Spanish, so we're going to listen and then translate afterwards.
Se metió el gobierno para acá. Se metieron allí.
¿Qué pasa ya? No me hagas tener miedo. ¿Qué pasa?
So we've got one resident saying the government is inside the building. And then another woman that you hear there, clearly afraid, she's saying, what's wrong? Don't scare me. What else should we know, Jody?
I mean, I think you can just hear, especially in the friend's voice, just how in real time, how scary that moment was. Mm-hmm. And in other messages we've heard that were exchanged, you know, on WhatsApp, and in real time, you can hear the helicopter whirling ahead. And you just, you know, there were 300 agents there, and just you can hear in just the terror of, you know, the people who were inside. Mm-hmm. And we've heard that from, you know, so many people who were living there, whether they were, you know, Venezuelans or U.S. citizens.
Right. And so we're clear. Did the government actually take any legal action against the people who were taken that night?
Nobody has been criminally charged.
And that's the crux of your investigation, right?
That is one of the findings, is that nobody was charged in immigration court. Like I said, there's been the government has not provided any evidence of criminal history. And the people we talked to, they were working, just hardworking. A lot of them were hardworking people. There were problems in that building, for sure. There was a murder there earlier this year. There was violence. There were so many 911 calls. It's not that this was some perfect building, but there were also really just regular hardworking people who were getting up in the morning and going to Home Depot and finding a job or working. I talked to one in his boss in Chinatown. He washed dishes in a restaurant there. So there were all kinds of people living there, and you can hear they were very scared in that moment.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, I pass by that building regularly on my way back and forth to Indiana. And it's not on the resident. I mean, a lot of buildings down there, they house a lot of people who may be blue collar, working hard. And the problems in that building is not on the tenants. But I keep going back to, how did this building get on the radar of ICE in the first place? And you could just feel the pain and the fear. Yeah. The woman was talking to her husband there, and it's just, and was it all for show? Was it all for cameras?
Yeah, definitely sounded shaken on just that clip that we saw. So I can imagine the rest of the tape. And as part of the investigation, ProPublica went to, 8 immigration hearings?
Correct.
Of the folks who were detained. Any other takeaways for you, or anything that surprised you along the way?
I think just the way how people are trying to deal with it now. I mean, so many people's lives were upended that night. Families torn apart. There's a mom who's living with her 3 very young daughters in a shelter now in Chicago. Her husband is in detention. Two of her daughters are U.S. citizens. It's just the number of families who have been really impacted. And the building is now, as of recently, it's now in receivership. A judge has ordered that all the remaining tenants, which are there about 36 of them, be moved elsewhere. Greg Bovino said that the building was going to be safer. I was there fairly recently, and so were city inspectors, and floors are flooded. The elevators are not working. I talked with a woman on the 3rd floor whose legs have been amputated. She uses a wheelchair, and she has no way out of the building. So it's there are a lot of people who are really impacted.
And that middle of the night sweep did not do what Trump said it was going to do, right? Drive down crime, et cetera. Right. So any idea what happens next, Jody, for these Venezuelan immigrants who were accused of being gang members but never charged? What happens now?
So some of them are back in Venezuela, and some are still in detention in Indiana, in Kentucky, in Texas, and they are waiting either to leave the country or they might be impacted by this other judge's recent ruling that they are to be released because this was a warrantless search and warrantless enforcement action, and they might be able to be released.
Wow. WBEZ's Claire Lane and Michael Puente, and that was Jody Cohen from ProPublica. To see reporting on Venezuelan immigrants and the South Shore raid by Jody and her colleagues, head over to ProPublica.org.
This episode of the In the Loop podcast was produced by me, Meha Ahmed, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/in the loop. Thanks for listening.